You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
For our reading today, we have a very short passage from John. As I doubt the author of John knew what a Pandora's box he'd be opening when he wrote them, it's good to remember the context of its origin. In the wake of the temple's destruction and the growing split between the synagogue and the Jesus movement, there's no love lost between John and the Jewish establishment. And he sometimes scripts Jesus using ugly us versus them language. That's important to remember because John's rhetoric has contributed to centuries of anti-Semitism. Whenever the Bible seems to promote contempt for other people, that's our cue to look carefully at the historical context rather than baptize somebody else's ancient conflict as a sacred text. So, when hearing our passage today, a promise of abundance from Jesus himself, remember that this is right in the middle of John's effort to discredit the Jews and promote all the benefits of choosing Jesus over Judaism.
Our words of wisdom are from chapter 10 of John, verse 10b.
Jesus said, "I came that they may have life and have it abundantly."
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
Language is a funny thing. English is particularly crazy for ESL students. Many of our words can mean exactly the opposite of themselves. Take the word fast. It can mean both moving rapidly, as in running fast, or fixed, unmoving, as in holding fast. If colors are fast, they will not run. How about off? It means deactivated, as in to turn off. But it also can mean activated, as in the alarm went off. Or how about screen? It can mean to show, like a movie, or to hide, as in an unsightly view. So it's with some trepidation that I dip into Chinese and offer a hackney old adage, usually offered by non-Chinese speakers, saying that the Chinese word for busy is composed of two characters, heart and death or killing. While I think many Chinese speakers would never think about this, it's interesting to me to note how the characters come together. I offer that observation because for many of us, our lives are already extremely busy. We can't imagine squeezing in one more thing, especially something as fuzzy as spiritual practice. In 1845, Henry David Thoreau was in a similar place in his life. Not the kind of guy that did anything half-heartedly. He took off for Walden Pond to live in isolation and find out, before he died, whether he had ever lived. It's a good question. Is there more to life? How can I live more deeply? How can I connect with the divine? What is this fullness of life that Jesus promises when he says, "I have come that you may have life and have it more abundantly"? So what exactly does abundantly mean anyway? Christians typically point to this passage as justification for a gospel of prosperity and the promise of a literal, lavish, rich, and opulent material lifestyle. But people miss the fact that the original hearers would have recognized the Greek word John uses, perissos, as part of an ancient Greek idiom that indeed refers to overflowing material wealth, but in a clever twist, is applying it to a spiritual reality. Think of our modern phrase, an embarrassment of riches. It's not about money, but about an overwhelming, humbling amount of love, gratitude, or inner peace. Or what do we say when we've experienced a profound, deeply satisfying conversation or been impacted by the sense of awe brought on by an encounter with a natural wonder or work of art? It's what? A feast for the soul, right? Or maybe my cup overflows. Is there a literal feast? No. A literal cup? No. But we use these idioms that reference the physical world to express emotional or spiritual contentment so immense we can't describe them any other way. Overflowing, beyond measure, more than enough. Not more stuff, more life. But our modern, shallow, late-stage capitalist, prosperity gospel indoctrinated little selves hear the word abundance, and we immediately start counting square footage, retirement accounts, frequent flyer miles, vacation homes, followers, or storage units full of things we forgot we even owned. We have been conditioned to believe that abundance is measured by accumulation, when what John's Jesus is doing is measuring abundance in aliveness. Guess what? These are two entirely different economies. One asks, how much do you have? The other asks, how fully are you living? One is obsessed with growth and stockpiling. The other can only be experienced. People aren't lying awake at 2 a.m. wondering how they can become more spiritual. They're wondering why they're exhausted, anxious, and feeling lonely in a world where everyone is supposedly more connected than any time in human history. Maybe the better question is, how do we remain fully human, authentically our unique, never-to-be-repeated selves, in a culture that profits from making us something less? I don't think it's paranoid to recognize that every screen, algorithm, advertisement, and political message is competing for our finite attention, quietly teaching us what to desire, whom to fear, and what supposedly really matters. We aren't merely being influenced, we're being formed. I think that's why Rabbi Avram Davis, who not only has a PhD in the history of consciousness, but is the founder of a meditation center in California, has said, "We are what we practice." The question isn't whether or not we're being formed. We are. The question is, into what? And maybe that's exactly why spiritual practice matters. Not because God needs more religious people, but because we need ways of becoming more fully, dare I say, abundantly alive. Not religious, alive. Not worshipful, prayerful, or more pure than the next person. But as Frederick and Marianne Brossat point out in their spiritual literacy series, spiritual literacy is the ability to recognize the presence of the sacred in everyday experiences. That means developing practices like mindfulness, where everyday activities like walking, washing the dishes, or a quiet meal can become opportunities to be fully aware of the amazing gift of life. Likewise, Brother David Steindl-Rast, a Benedictine mystic who incidentally just turned 100 a few days ago, happy birthday, David, wrote, "Sometimes people get the mistaken notion that spirituality is a separate department of life, the penthouse of our existence. But rightly understood, it is a vital awareness that pervades all realms of our being. Someone will say, 'I come alive when I listen to music,' or 'I come to life when I garden,' or 'I come alive when I play golf.'" He goes on to say that wherever we are most alive, that is the area in which we are spiritual. And then we can say, to be vital, awake, aware, in all areas of our lives is the task that is never accomplished. But in that one area, I know how one is spiritual. Notice where Jesus seems to have found the divine: while walking dusty roads, eating dinner with strangers, noticing lilies growing in fields, birds building nests, women kneading bread, children playing in the street, laborers mending fishing nets. The sacred is everywhere. The problem is we're constantly being manipulated into doubting our own experience of it. We've been trained to be wary of our own spiritual hunches and then miss where the holy is uniquely at work in our everyday lives. When I was a chaplain at Good Samaritan, we did a lot of work with cancer patients and visualization, a practice of meditating where patients could strengthen their immune system and their body's ability to fight cancer by entering an almost dream state and visualizing their body fighting off the cancer. I remember hearing the story of one patient who, despite all the best intentions, was having trouble with his daily imagery meditation. As part of the program, he'd been encouraged to imagine thousands of tiny sharks with sharp teeth hunting cancer cells in his body. He didn't relate to this imagery, so he found it hard to do it consistently. But there was an image that he was good at: catfish. As a child, he'd kept catfish as pets and knew that they were a bottom feeder that never sleeps and is known for its ability to sort waste products from the good material in an aquarium. At first, his therapist dismissed the image as not vicious enough, but for the patient, catfish represented vigilance, devotion, and unconditional love. He created his own imagery exercises around catfish caring for his body. This was a practice he could remember to do because it was unique to his experience. That story has stuck with me because it's also an illustration of how religion has an unfortunate habit of foisting somebody else's sharks on us. Prayers that don't sound like us, practices that don't fit us, images that leave us cold. Meanwhile, our own catfish are patiently waiting. So forget the notion that spirituality requires special training or somebody else's formula. Wherever you genuinely come alive, pay attention. That ordinary experience may be holier than you think. And I think Jesus was particularly gifted at the practice of paying attention. People would ask him theological questions, and he'd tell them a story about seeds. They ask about heaven, and he points to birds. They ask who's in and who's out, and he sits down to dinner with precisely the people they hoped he'd give them permission to exclude. Jesus is forever taking the long way around because abundant life is not about following somebody else's rules or reaching some destination where everything has already been resolved. The kind of abundance Jesus is talking about is already spilling over along the way, if only we're awake enough to notice it. The fancy theological word that describes that phenomena is panentheism, seeing all things in God and God alive within all things. As the ancient Welsh poet says of the divine, "I am the wind that breathes upon the sea. I am the wave on the ocean. I am the murmur of leaves rustling." Then moves on through sunlight and moonlight, trees breaking into blossom, salmon swimming, wild boars fighting, stags running, oxen pulling the plow, until the illusion that the sacred exists somewhere other than right here and now simply dissolves. And what about those wind phones? The idea began in Japan after the 2011 earthquake and tsunami. An old disconnected telephone placed in a quiet spot where grieving people could pick up the receiver and talk to someone who had died. Now there are hundreds of them around the world, in parks, cemeteries, hospitals, and gardens. Does anybody actually hear you? Who knows? That's not really the point. The phone simply gives grief somewhere to go, a ritual for saying what was left unsaid. Intriguing? Goofy? Shark? Catfish? As Mechthild of Magdeburg says, "The day of my spiritual awakening was the day I saw and knew I saw all things in God and God in all things." Maybe that's why Jesus could look at lilies, vineyards, sparrows, bread, water, and ordinary human beings and see more than objects. He saw parousos, opportunities for life overflowing, an embarrassment of riches in the deepest sense, more beauty, courage, tenderness, and wonder than the heart knows how to hold. In his acts of generosity, grace, and justice, in his bringing attention to the most basic elements of life, Jesus was essentially reminding us that where our attention goes, our life follows. And a sense of gratitude is what happens when we stop taking that life for granted. In the end, the opposite of gratitude is not ingratitude, but simply failing to notice the power of E.E. Cummings' morning prayer. "I thank you, God, for this most amazing day." Not because every day is amazing. Between the wars, cruelty, corruption, injustice, and warming planet, most days are heartbreaking. It means refusing to let any of it become the only reality we see. It means there's still compassion that has not been exhausted, wonder that has not been monetized, joy that has not been earned, and love that has not run out. That, I think, is what Jesus means by life parousos. Not a life insulated from sorrow, but a life so deep and wide that sorrow can't define it. Not a life of accumulation, but aliveness. Not more stuff, but more life. When Irenaeus said, "The glory of God is the human person fully alive," he wasn't describing an achievement. He was describing a way of moving through the world awake enough to recognize parousos when it happens. So perhaps the question is not whether we've become spiritual enough, but what helps us remember that before the world knew our purchasing power, before an algorithm learned our habits, before anyone tried to turn us into a consumer, a demographic, a voter, or a target, life, and life perissos, was already breathing through us. The same life moving through wind and water, lilies and vineyards, burning bushes and empty tombs. Jesus' promise is not some guarantee about material success, but a promise that genuine abundance is in becoming so awake to life itself that another human being encountering us, without quite knowing why, might feel a little less afraid, a little less alone, a little more human, and maybe even a little more alive themselves. That's a Jesus kind of abundance, because perissos was never about having more. It was about discovering there is more to being alive than we ever imagined, more beauty than we've noticed, more love than we've known, more compassion than we've thought possible, more wonder than we've allowed ourselves, more life here and now than any of us can fully comprehend. Maybe that's what Jesus meant by life perissos, life overflowing. Not that we're getting a bigger cup, but that the life Jesus is talking about won't be contained. Be well. Hey, and don't forget, if you like what you heard today, buy me a coffee.
Thanks, Ryan.
Anytime.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.